All right, folks. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. Welcome to yet another live stream. And we are joined today by a very special guest. Samuel Miller McDonald is a geographer focusing on human ecology, theory, and history. He holds a doctorate from Brasenose College, University of Oxford, and degrees from Yale University and College of the Atlantic. His latest book on progress is set to put his name, if I may say so, next to the likes of David Graeber for its bold, provocative, wide-ranging argument about the human idea of progress. As the book's blurb illuminates, narratives of progress, the stories we tell about whether society is moving in the right or the wrong direction, are immensely potent. Progress has built cities, flattened mountains, charted the globe, delved the oceans and space, created wealth, opportunity, and remarkable innovation, and ushered in a new epoch unique in our planet's 4.5 billion years of history. But the modern story of progress is also a very dangerous fiction. It shapes our sense of what progress means and justifies what we will do to achieve it, no matter the cost. Samuel Miller McDonald, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for that, Andrew. Happy to be here.
Should I continue using your full name or?
Sam's fine.
Sounds fine. Okay, great. So, this book and really this conversation as well has been years in the making. I remember reaching out, I can't even remember what year it was, but many years ago. Can you tell me a bit about, how this came to be?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I remember that. It's been a while of me kind of getting back in touch with you to say, not quite ready yet, but soon. So I'm glad we finally got here and having this conversation. Yeah, a lot of the base research for it started with my DPhil at Oxford, which I started in 2016. And that project kind of bifurcated into two sort of separate strands. One strand was this kind of historical, archival documents, theoretical sort of strand of research. And the other one was doing interviews of people who are involved in like community renewable energy, involved in eco-socialist politics, a little bit in government, a little bit in private business. And so for the thesis, those two kind of came together. But for this book, I really just took from the kind of historical side of that research and then added on another sort of theoretical element. And then I've drawn from a lot of my articles that I've been writing over the last 9 years or so. Drawing together a lot of different kinds of disciplines and taking little bits from a lot of different scholars in the social sciences, humanities, literature, history. And it's been a long process. I started the book itself in 2020 and I think delivered the last draft like maybe a year ago, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what made you choose to focus on progress specifically? Like, of all the concepts that you could have addressed, like growth or, any of these other massively influential things, why progress in particular?
Well, on the personal side of it is, I've been involved in kind of progressive activism for all my life. My parents were and still are activists, and kind of inducted me into that lifestyle pretty early. And a lot of the work that I've done before the academic work and then during it has been oriented around that, primarily like environmental justice, climate kinds of issues. And so the idea of progress is very personal. It's been something that is almost a kind of orienting belief, something that the whole kind of moral compass points toward, and I think I've been, because I've been so involved in these things, I've been watching the failure of these movements to really achieve even just a kind of slowdown of the damage and destruction and continual warming of the planet with dismay. And that dismay kind of, I think, led to wanting to interrogate this idea that history moves in a kind of progressive way, or maybe history doesn't, but activists and organizers and journalists and so forth can push it in that direction. I just started questioning that personally, and then at the same time, I wrote a couple of articles that were sort of in that vein of interrogating the idea. I wrote a piece for Current Affairs that was it's called Breaking Development, and it was kind of looking at the idea of development, where that came from, how that came to be such a neutral term that often applies to, harmful, destructive kinds of actions, or at least, very ambivalent kinds of actions. And when it came to the thesis research, it took a couple of years to coalesce into that, and then for the book as well. And I think for those projects, progress was kind of almost a vehicle for examining other things. Progress is it's an idea. It's a very abstract concept, and which has a really, I think, kind of clear cultural intellectual lineage that you can trace through records. But it accompanies a very material process. And I was
Right.
interested in that material process, and growth is the term we use now for that, and that process, and progress kind of just became a good way of tracing the history of that more material process as well.
Right. I mean, I really noticed that you took on the concept of progress from a lot of angles over the course of the book. And you also map out a sort of narrative timeline on progress, like you say, in this history of the concept going way back into history. Do you mind giving a short overview, an elevator pitch maybe, of how progress as a story evolved over time? I know that's the crux of the entire book, but if you could give a quick run through.
Yeah, sure. And just preface it by saying it is a very kind of Western centric or Eurocentric, because it's that those are the sources I'm drawing from. I'm able to access just linguistically, and because that's kind of right now that's where this kind of progress narrative is most potent, I think, and is. It's that's still where a lot of the wealth and power and source of these problems are. So the narrative starts in Mesopotamia, texts like Enuma Elish and Epic of Gilgamesh, where I'm tracing the kind of growth of a new sort of society, we could call market empires, these market-based societies, very hierarchical, very environmentally destructive. They start to develop these myths that are progressive, that kind of glorify that process of environmental destruction and expansion. I move to look at Persian versions of this, like Zoroastrianism, and then Judaism and Christianity. I look at the Pax Romana, and the period of stability during the Roman Empire, which kind of took on a more secular version of of a kind of progress narrative. I then look at how that kind of filtered Christianity into Europe, and then how the European monarchies took Christianity, turned it into a real, political tool, and then used it to kind of justify the colonization first in South America, and then in North America. I then trace the kind of development of the progress narrative through the Islamic Golden Age, and then through the European Enlightenment, which actually both have a lot of really interesting kind of parallels in the ideas they develop, but they do so largely independently. And in the European case, these narratives secularize a lot more, And you know, they kind of shed a lot of the Christian mysticism and you know, mythology. And we start to see what we think of as like liberalism today, essentially. And that ideology gets really made central to the process of colonizing North America, and turns into this kind of industrial era narrative around evolution and manifest destiny. At this point, we have, you know, fossil fuels coming in and kind of supercharging the process of extraction and production. And then we see the 20th century, this kind of, you know, big battle between different ideologies, and what combines these ide or what you know, binds these ideologies is this narrative of progress that runs through all of them. That then brings us to the present, where we kind of have this, you know, consensus around a kind of neoliberalism, and the, you know, narrative of progress that accompanies that. And it really, that narrative ends with this kind of period that we're in now, which is there's a kind of breakdown in that consensus around neoliberalism, but it's being replaced by this very kind of odd Silicon Valley, you know, mysticism around, you know, worshiping AI and getting rid of human beings, and you know, even returning to some kind of Christian mythology, as you see people like, you know, Peter Thiel coming in and talking about the Antichrist. And then you know, I try to end the book as well by talking about what should progress look like, what could it look like in the coming decades and century. And that's as far as I take it.
You mentioned the book that, well, the tech brewers that are running the world right now are running on this delusion almost of a secular messiah, you know, that they embody our salvation, that their imagined technologies will save us, despite the fact that this myth of progress is impossible to sustain. That it will come to an end. It is, as you say, encoded to collapse. How did you reach that conclusion precisely? What's the science behind that understanding that the great acceleration of the post-war period, of the industrial period, is not coming back in a sequel?
So I guess I start that by looking at what some of these, you know, historical market empires, these, you know, growthist progressive empires do, and it's often, you know, boom and bust. They grow quickly, and then they collapse and contract. And you know, I think what we have today is a kind of global example of that process. This really, like, you know, networked intertwined network of these kinds of boom and bust societies, growthist societies, and companies and governments. And you know, the fact is that we have a kind of a limit to available energy and mass, and those are just, you know, those are physical laws of the universe. And eventually you just can't sustain that constant increase in energy expenditure or consumption of mass and production of waste. You hit a wall with that. And I think in the case of this sort of global system that we have now, I wouldn't want to, you know, predict how long that kind of contraction or disintegration might take, or even when it will accelerate and become kind of you know, unstoppable. If it already has, I don't know. That's just something that I think is a bit beyond prediction. But it
Right.
is, you know, we can know that it's inevitable. You just can't have a perpetually growing you know, system. It's just how it works. And I think, you know, right now we're just seeing a lot of, because it's so big and so networked and interwoven, I think we're seeing a lot of you know, disparate crises that look discrete from, you know, from the middle of them, but are kind of part of this bigger you know, contraction of energy and mass and that kind of available, stuff.
Right. You mentioned networked, and the nature of this system being networked, it reminds me of the way that you, I suppose, split up the phases of history. And of course, any grand narrative of history is bound to have, shortcomings, it's bound to be incomplete in some ways. Mm-hmm. But you describe these phases as forms of parasitism. And the form that we live within today is the networked parasitism. Can you go a bit into that and how parasitism has developed across human history?
Sure, yeah. And just to, very quickly, I'm using that term parasitism as a kind of, coming from ecology. I'm also using mutualism and commensalism, just kind of forms of extraction that either do harm, don't do harm, or do a lot of harm. And so like in the case of, mutualism, you have a form of extraction that's mutually beneficial. In the form of in commensalism, you have extraction that's non-harmful or minimally harmful. And then parasitism is this form of extraction that is very harmful, often to the point of collapse or, a severe degradation of an ecological system. And so, you're absolutely right to say any kind of periodization of history is just a framework. It's not going to capture a lot of, how actual historical change happens. The periodization I'm putting forward is a kind of, we start with this contiguous parasitism where you have, a city state, a kind of centralized single entity that is just spreading out its borders in a sort of contiguous way, absorbing things around it. Then there's this kind of disparate parasitism where you have something, a nation state usually sending out, in the case that I'm talking about, primarily maritime supply chains. So, the British Empire being the big example of that, pulling, extracted resources back into its kind of economy and its central, city or state. And then the period that we're in is this networked parasitism where you have this really kind of dense network of states, large corporate bureaucracies, non-state actors, all of them kind of working together or working in conflict to do this, really hyper fast and large scale, large volume extraction all over the world, and having a kind of metabolism that covers pretty much every country in the world. And I think that's partly that delivers a certain kind of resilience in the face of things like, climate disasters or environmental collapses. If you have, drought in one place, theoretically, you can alleviate that with the resources in another place. But I think it also builds in vulnerabilities. We see that when you get like one critical spot in a supply chain gets disrupted, that sends, a kind of cascading impact through the rest of the world, through the rest of that network. And I think the difficult part right now is that we really can't predict what the climate's going to do, how governments are going to respond to what the climate does. And so whether that network is going to be resilient or more vulnerable, I think is just, up for debate. And my concern is that it's more vulnerable, is that once you start introducing these kinds of shocks, that it just spreads through the whole thing and eventually, culminates in large scale conflict and, the kind of like civil unrest that we're seeing in a lot of places today. And even the kind of, anti-immigrant responses we're seeing in the UK and the US, which I think is driven at least in part by the Pentagon looking ahead and saying, you know, we're expecting 2 billion climate refugees, so we're going to start figuring out how to shut the gates now.
Yeah, I absolutely see that. And honestly, any sort of conversation about the Pentagon or the intelligence services is, it borders, or it can feel like it borders on the paranoid or the conspiracist. But this is really, we're operating based on what they have admitted to doing publicly, not to mention the things that they have not yet done. And I think you had a really critical note about, you know, all these three-letter agencies in the system in terms of how they are used to maintain fear, division, and a sort of cruel suppression against those who would rise up, that their main role is to intimidate, to divide, and to conquer.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a chapter, one of the last, maybe second to last, in the historical section, which is looking at how, I mean, it starts out looking at how all of these historic empires employed kind of, you know, secret security services, intelligence services. It's this very old kind of tradition in empires, and then shifts the focus to today, where we have, in the US, it's the largest by far intelligence apparatus that has ever existed. So one of the things that comes up in that is this Pentagon video that was released internally, talking about how they anticipate cities as, basically big slums where a lot of violence occurs and you have this like a, you know, kind of factory of unrest and terrorism and, you know, whatever. And that's what they're anticipating. And that's, they're kind of directing, the armed forces in a direction of being able to deploy these kinds of targeted strikes in cities, in slums. I think even while you have a lot of the world's governments being publicly very much in denial of climate change and environmental issues, I think internally they're doing a lot of things to prepare for that, or not prepare for it in a good way that we might want them to, but prepare for what they see as a threat to them and to this kind of order that they have, that they're establishing and protecting.
I mean, honestly, I'm already seeing such activity in my own country, both in terms of the efforts to sow those kinds of ideological divisions and, you know, xenophobias and other prejudices against desperate populations. And, you know, the US military is literally stationed in my country right now. The intelligence services are likely also operating in my country right now, in Trinidad and Tobago, and using their position in Trinidad and Tobago to also get themselves involved in operations in Venezuela. And so it may sound a bit disconnected from this talk about intelligence services, but in my mind, I see a connection between how intelligence services are operating and the role that AI may play in maintaining the system. In the sense Absolutely. That I think both the intelligence services and AI, whether in the form of artificial photos, videos, text, they serve to make the landscape of truth and those who wish to stand for truth harder to navigate. You know, it makes the landscape of truth harder to navigate, and also makes people who wish to stand for truth face a greater challenge in sorting what is true and what is false, what is real and what is not.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's a part in that chapter as well about a video that kind of got a little bit of attention put out by one of the like psychological operations units in the Army, in the U.S. Army. And, you know, in it, they're basically, you know, bragging about doing exactly that, about disrupting information, essentially, and information networks you know, doing mass deception campaigns and claiming to, you know, be everywhere all the time. They see everything. They're, you know, in the shadows or whatever. It's a very dramatic video. I agree totally. I think AI is central to that. It's going to be central. It's already being used for, you know, surveillance, for drone warfare. I think it's primarily going to be deployed for these sorts of ends.
Definitely. And I think also the function of AI, it's meant to, I think, demoralize as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to create this sense that we are dealing with, you know, a force beyond our control. And that was already a sort of a narrative that we were already contending with. You know, like you were mentioning, the intelligence services and empires throughout history have always managed to put forward this image that they are untouchable, unstoppable, omnipotent, omniscient. And while they have technologies that were unthinkable centuries ago, I think it is also important to recognize that they are not, you know, those things, that these systems are still run by people with addresses and systems that have actual material bases of operations that can be confronted, it can be disrupted if we want to see a change in the status quo in the state of affairs.
Yeah, it's good to remember that for sure. And especially that, you know, something that I argue is that some of these intelligence organizations, CIA, for instance, they really intentionally put forward a face of, you know, not just being scary and psychopathic, but being highly competent. But what they've shown over and over again is that they're really not competent, and that they've, you know, so many of their operations have just failed because of that incompetence. And I think as you see the, you know, Border Patrol and ICE, and how they've handled this, you know, this operation that they're currently undertaking, obviously, you know, very brutal, very much willing to do violence and break the law. But they're also largely a bunch of unfit morons who, you know, aren't particularly competent people. I mean, just there was some reports about the recruitment of new ICE agents, and they're just scraping the bottom of the barrel. And I think at least we can take a little bit of solace from that fact. And, you know, and they are going to keep making mistakes, and they're never going to be able to build a perfect dystopia that is able to trap everybody all the time. And I think that's also something that I put in the book that is a source of at least a little bit of comfort, is that there will always be strands in the world of peace and tranquility and justice and fairness. And it's about kind of finding those strands, even if they're narrow, even if they're buffeted by a lot of violence and chaos, they'll always be there. And, you know, and it's just a matter of trying to find those and widen them.
I agree. I think also, and I do want to end this on a positive note, but before we do so, I want to quickly, I guess, address the potential counter arguments to your arguments against the idea of progress and its role in our society. You do actually admit in the book and address some of these compelling arguments, the idea of progress. You know, you, for example, point to how we went from flying the world's first aircraft in 1903 to ending up sending a man to space with the Soviet cosmonaut in 1961. And so this story of human flight is packaged with the broader great acceleration. But can you tell me a bit, or tell us rather, a bit more about that period and why it is that many of the examples people can point to about progress aren't necessarily as challenging to your central thesis as they might imagine?
Sure. Do you mean the Great Acceleration in particular, that period?
Yeah, that the role of the great acceleration has played in our understanding of progress, and also how a lot of the ideas that people trot out about, examples of progress aren't really a challenge to your main point in the book.
Certainly. You know what? I want to. I think this came out only a little bit. I didn't spend as much time on it as I did other things, but I do believe in, or want to believe in, the possibility of a kind of, high-tech civilization that is able to explore other planets, that is able to produce a kind of, high energy, or at least, mid-level kind of energy civilization with some urbanism and some kind of technological set of conveniences, that I do think there is value to that, or at least there's a kind of vision of that sort of society that I think can be valuable. I think the problem is that the vision that is guiding so much of technological development today is just driven by these values that really have nothing to do with, like what Elon Musk says is that he's building these spaceships to extend the light of consciousness to the stars. That would be great if he were actually doing that. He's not doing that. That's not what motivates him. What motivates him is wealth and power, and that's it. And I think that's true of all of these tech companies, is that their incentives and the things driving these CEOs, who are by and large, either psychopaths or on a lot of drugs and, checked out of reality. What's driving them is the same thing that drives all the other emperors. It's just their own glorification. It's just expansion and extraction. And I think for all of the good things about the Great Acceleration, that period, and you did see a greater equalizing of wealth, you did see this rapid expansion of technology. What you saw alongside that was the rapid proliferation of pollution and, carcinogens in the environment. You saw the acceleration of extinctions and, transformation of land into developed, factories, farms, houses, away from wilderness and habitat. And you saw the rapid expansion of fossil energy infrastructure, and it was the kind of seed of what we see today, since around 2000, where you've seen this almost kind of exponential increase in carbon emissions, and then all the problems that come with that. And so, what I'm trying to speak about in the book a little bit is, how do we have this vision of a high-tech society that's also long-term sustainable, that doesn't just boom and bust? And I think, part of the answer to that, and there's a lot of things that are needed, but part of the answer is reorienting those values away from, seeking profit, seeking surpluses, seeking power, above everything else, and instead reinfusing institutions with more pro-social goals, goals that have a kind of common good ethic to them, and that have a biocentric ethic, a multi-species kind of ethic to them as well.
And of course, we also see that ethic in the practices of certain societies that are considered pre-modern as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I try to kind of say, we can't, or at least many of us can't, simply wholesale adopt a given, you know, indigenous nation as a kind of model, given where we are now. But there are so many kind of, you know, moral, philosophical, and some technical lessons as well that I think can be integrated from those kinds of mutualistic, commensalistic societies that we see as pre-modern, but that I think are very, they've cultivated societies that were sustained for tens of millennia. And I think that's the kind of thing that we have to be trying to emulate right now.
I think also when we look to these societies and we take examples from them and inspiration from them in terms of the ethic, in terms of the practices, it really is that sort of inversion of the narrative of progress, because we're not looking forward, we're looking back, or looking to the present. And you had this quote that really stuck with me in the book, where you said that whether or when progress can be shown to have occurred depends entirely on when measurements start and end, where the lens is focused, how those measurements are conducted, and what data researchers choose to include or omit.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the, you know, a lot of the graphs that get put out that say, you know, are trying to make the case that we're making this great progress, they omit those societies that I think have been sustained for so long because they had figured out how to coexist, how to, you know, sustainably extract from the environment, and how to live together, you know, live with each other in a way that doesn't result in warfare and exploitation. And I think as soon as you try to start including those things in those graphs, they change quite a bit. And, you know, the central part of this narrative, this progress narrative, is the empire coming along and civilizing those that they're conquering and absorbing. And I think that's kind of, you know, that's the opposite of what's happening. And what needs to happen is, I think these empires need to be civilized by the people that they've tried to eradicate.
Right. I think part of it too is that these statistics are not ever able to accurately reflect reality, because we don't have the information, the data necessary to accurately measure poverty across time and across parts of the world, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a graph is showing a very limited picture of a very complex phenomenon, and it can only ever do that. You know, that it's a very limited form. And I start the book just saying I think anytime you're confronted with those kinds of graphs, it's good to be skeptical and try to get a better sense of the historical context of whatever's being studied, whatever that phenomenon is. Try to get a sense of the methodology used to collect the data, and then get a sense of who's interpreting that data to create the graph, because, you know, all data goes through a subjective filter. And a lot of times the places and people putting these graphs out, they have an agenda, a political agenda, they have an ideology, and those agendas are, filtering the data and producing the graphs.
Yeah, I think a healthy bit of skepticism is absolutely warranted. I think that also applies to the narratives of social progress. I appreciated a lot of the Malcolm X quotes that you sprinkled in to the book, in particular, his quote about progress is not simply pulling the knife out 3 inches or 6 inches or pulling it out completely. Progress would be mending the wound caused by the knife in the first place. And unfortunately, society does not want to recognize that the knife is even there in the first place. Paraphrasing, of course.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, starting your kind of, your graph or your narrative at the worst possible moment. So in that case, where you have this, you know, influx of people who have been kidnapped, who have been put to the worst possible, you know, circumstances. And then 100 years later, things are a bit better. And calling that progress is just a, like, it's just a, it's really infuriating. And I think, you know, what Malcolm X is getting at is this tendency to overstate social progress, you know, progress in racial justice, social justice, is often nefarious. You know, it's often used for in order to prevent further progress in that direction. And so I think we also, you know, we have to be careful and skeptical when, you know, we see these kind of messages of we got to be hopeful, we got to keep pushing this you know, whatever this social kind of progress is presented as. I think we have to be careful not to let that actually dampen enthusiasm and make people complacent, and just put it in this full historical context that, you know, you can't call it progress if you're starting it from the worst possible moment, which was completely unnatural, which was, you know, this manufactured system that is just part of a lineage of, you know, other catastrophes. And yeah.
I agree. And I think that applies to any sort of social issue where one group has been disadvantaged by the systems imposed by another. And merely removing that system or modifying that system is not where I think our aspiration should lie. I think it should lie on actually furthering the safety and well-being of those people.
Definitely. And you know what I'm arguing in the book is that we can recognize when something good happens and call it that and say the world is better because this or that thing happened, because abolition happened, the world is a better place. We don't have to put that good thing into this narrative of progress, which may serve the ends of people who, you know, aren't necessarily in favor of further abolition. And that, you know, and I think throughout the book, this comes up where if there's kind of a positive change, I don't want to say that I'm against that or that that's bad or that we shouldn't want more of that. Just to say that how we understand the history of it, I think is important. And not necessarily understanding that history as this kind of, you know, Whig historiographic, teleological upward, you know, upward swing of history. The arc of the moral universe bending toward justice. You know, I think that kind of messaging isn't helpful because I think it can create a kind of complacency and deceive people into being comfortable with something they shouldn't be comfortable with.
I agree. And turning to a more positive note now, I suppose. Well, before I do so, this could be a decent segue, I think. At one point in the book, you call hope treacherous. Why is that? And what can we look to besides hope as we want to think about making changes to this status quo?
That's a great question that I think I toward the end of the book, I try to speak a little more philosophically, I guess, about that question. And, you know, when I say hope is treacherous, I think the issue with it is that it can become a stand-in for the satisfaction of triumph in the moment, in the present. And it can serve as a kind of ameliorating emotion that prevents people from doing the kind of hard things that need doing to deliver outcomes now and today. And I think especially with things like climate change and ecological collapse, where you have these real short timelines you know, we don't have centuries to solve this problem. I think that kind of, you know, placating emotion can be really dangerous and can be really harmful for these kinds of movements. And so what do you look for instead of that? And what's a kind of alternative? Because, you know, faith in a better future is very important. It gives people meaning, it gives comfort and solace and a you know, something to help forge ahead. And I don't think it's necessary to completely, you know, remove from oneself that belief in a future or faith in something happening. I talk about this kind of paradox of fighting for the moment, fighting for the present, but holding on to this kind of possibility of something happening in the future. I think it's important just to recognize that positive future is not inevitable and maybe not even likely, and that we still have to do these things anyway. We still have to fight for it anyway. And so I think there are a lot of other kinds of forms of solace that you can hold on to. And some of that is, you know, appreciating what still does exist. And there have been some good examples of, you know, species bounding back from extinction, for example, that I think can be very uplifting. I think you can find it in solidarity and working closely with people working on the same things and you know, kind of holding each other up instead of clinging to this sort of future ghost. You know, and for some people it's having children, and that's their anchor to the future, and, you know, working for that. I think it can vary. I think there are a lot of things to hold on to besides hope that can be nourishing in this very difficult time period and in these very difficult activities that have to happen.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite takeaways from the book was, in your words, that the future never arrives. We are imprisoned or liberated in a perpetual present. And I think it is possible to both fight for today and also in your actions today aim to reflect what you want such a future to look like. But I think it is very important to not stake our vision on some things in the future, to consider very seriously what is happening right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, recognizing that the future may look very different, even the near future, from what we have now, and conditions, you know, in some ways may be much worse, but they also may have openings for possibilities that we can't even imagine right now, or we're not imagining right now. And I think there's, you know, there's also comfort to be found in that kind of that ignorance about what can happen and what will happen, and that there is this kind of possibility for an opening up of alternatives, and you know, when that future arrives, we'll never know. It will just be the present, and I think that's important to remember as well, that in this time where it kind of feels like nothing ever changes, or if it does, it changes for the worse, that things can change very quickly for the better, and that maybe it won't be universal, and maybe it won't be perfect, but there are these very kind of unexpected things that can happen, and turn things around.
I agree. What are some of the things that you think that we can do in our present to push our relation with the natural world, to push our society towards a more commensalistic or mutualistic arrangement?
So I have maybe five kind of short chapters toward the end that go through a lot of different things that are, you know, they range from, you know, kind of personal actions to bigger sort of policy programs and, you know, that kind of more macro scale changes. And I mean, I think at a personal level, it's just being very active and trying to, you know, all strategy is hyper-local or should be hyper-local. You know, all strategy should be designed at the closest spatial and temporal sort of place that it's happening. And so that means being engaged with, you know, if there's some development that's going to come and destroy the habitat near where you live, being engaged in stopping that however you can and, you know, getting people together to stop that. Or I think it means in, you know, unfortunately sometimes going to planning meetings, in cities and, you know, trying to intervene. If there's, you know, I've been involved in some of this and there's a lot of corruption at that level of government, that kind of, you know, city level of government when it comes to planning decisions and building decisions. And, so the book talks about, you know, redesigning the kind of relationship between rural and urban spaces and how you intervene in those, in that kind of process of design. And some of that is just, it happens at the policymaking level and you just kind of have to be involved in the, you know, in the policymaking. But a lot of it happens at the grassroots and at the street level as well. You know, and some of the policies I point to are things like things you'll be familiar with, the rewilding, the land back, UBIs and you know, implementing agroecology programs, and kind of instituting funding for agroecology, certain kinds of renewables and, you know, and then, you know, zoning renewables in a way that doesn't destroy habitat as well. Course, right. I think it, you know, it's just kind of, it takes a lot. It takes a lot of different kinds of people operating at a lot of different levels, and then it, you know, so often just comes back to the old, we got to organize. That's, you know, no getting around it. Just got to get everyone together and coordinate actions, whether that's, you know, unions and intervening directly in production, or whether that's you know, swamping planning meetings and, you know, doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, I certainly encourage people as sort of the project of my channel to look outside of the official channels to build things independent of those. But I know that there are going to be people engaged in those sort of demand-based engagements with the state. And to the extent that they are able to, you know, eke out those wins, more power to them. But I think for me, I really want us to focus on what we can do to extricate ourselves from this system, because I really don't see the change coming from within. And you do also talk about that in the book, how much of the resistance historically has come from outside of the system, rather than within.
Exactly. I certainly agree. And yeah, and I think, you know, the most kind of potent objections to imperial expansion has almost always come from the people outside the borders of the empire and you know, the indigenous groups are the groups that are targeted for conquest. And sometimes they've succeeded and repelled imperial incursions. And sometimes they haven't and succumb to it. But that does seem to be where most of the most effective resistance comes from. And I think that's even true today. You know, you see probably the most effective opposition to development and reductions in climate emissions coming from, you know, water protectors, land protectors, indigenous groups, that are, you know, doing this very hard work of being on the front lines and you know, occupying zones, targeted for conquest. And I think that remains true. It remains very dangerous and something that, you know, I think requires a lot of support, you know, from all sides. And I think there is also, you know, things that people can do, that are more, you know, to trying to throw together, like agroecological projects and renewable energy projects. That was part of what I was doing, for my DPhil thesis, was looking at, community scale renewables and how people have kind of, you know, come together to, do, you know, funding and construction of these decentralized energy projects. And I think there is definitely value in that. And, you know, you can get a lot of, hopefulness from that, from seeing that happening as well.
Yeah. And I suppose to wrap up, we can conclude with the question that I chose to title the live stream. Is progress humanity's worst idea?
That's what my UK publishers would tell you. I think it's, I don't want to get too abstract here. I talk about it as a kind of narrative formula. It's a kind of, you know, rhetorical infrastructure or technology that I think has been very destructive, maybe more so than any other kind of rhetorical or narrative framework. I think there, you know, there have been moments where ideas of progress have been used for good things and have been effective in helping people organize around good things, whether it's, you know, labor movements you know, some of the public sanitation movements or you know, social justice. I think there have been some good victories that have been, you know, people have rallied around progress narratives. So I don't want to say it's all bad all the time. But I think on the whole, you look at the history and you look at it as this kind of not just one idea, but a collection of ideas. I think it comes out pretty bad.
Yeah, I got you. It is, I think, something that people almost have visceral reactions to when you even try to broach the subject. You know, it's because of how wrapped up that story is in our approach and understanding of the world.
Definitely. And there's for sure some British people who are very upset with me. And I'm sure there will be some in the US as well, as this gets a little bit more attention. But yeah, it's hard. And I tried, and maybe I didn't try hard enough in the book, but I did try sometimes to soften that a little bit and you know, try to put in a little bit of consolations to that and to say, you know, shedding this idea and ridding ourselves of this kind of framework is just a first step. And then I think beyond that, you know, approaching things with a little clearer eyes, we can hopefully, you know, find other things to get a bit of consolation from.
Yeah. No, I really do want to let you go, but a comment left in the live chat caught my eye because it is something that you address directly in the book. Someone commented that progress is not an idea. It's a progressive force of history. And that reminds me a bit about how you approached Marx in the book and how his understanding of progress changed over the course of his life.
Yeah, exactly. So Marx starts, you know, early in his career with that kind of viewpoint, that this sort of teleology, this belief that history moves progressively, that we can, you know, predict that it will move in this direction, and that it's just a natural kind of force of history. As he got older, as he developed his ideas further, he rejected that idea, and he started to instead focus on you know, how we can find examples of what he considered a kind of ideal classless societies in existing indigenous or past indigenous examples of societies. And his ethnographic notebooks, he started to bring those ideas together, but never finished that, obviously. And but he was, you know, by the end, he was, or later on, not even by the end, but just later on in his career, he was looking at what we can learn from these earlier societies, and that, you know, this idea that everything is moving in one direction to this one perfect state, to this, you know, stasis point, just isn't really true. That's just not how history actually moves or happens.
But it is a comforting grand narrative.
It is, for sure. Yeah. And, but you know, the kind of 5,000 year period we live in now is an aberration. You know, our species has existed for 300,000 years. And in those 300,000 years, there's been a lot of history. There's been a lot of different kinds of societies that have developed in all different kinds of ways. And this thing that we see, this kind of weird period that we're in now, is an anomaly. And I think assuming that that's the natural way that human beings are and history develops is just not really borne out by, you know, by research.
Yeah. I mean, me personally, I don't lean much on Marxian analysis, but I know a lot of people do. And it really was interesting for me to see in the book that sort of grappling with his evolution of ideas over time, particularly because you don't tend to hear about the sort of later developments in his work.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't call my work or the book Marxian, but I definitely do feel like I've gained a lot from it. I do quote him a lot. I gain a lot from his analysis, and I think, you know, I appreciate very much that he was able to evolve as a scholar and a thinker, and that he was willing to kind of, you know, develop his frameworks, change them as he understood more. I think I talk about that most in the kind of industrial period where evolution becomes this really potent idea. Darwin is this kind of the big titan of the age, and you have Marx and Engels who are very, you know, enamored with Darwin, and, you know, Marx is sending him fan letters. And then at the same time, you have Herbert Spencer, who's very enamored with Darwin. You know, and these guys are on, you know, different sides of the political spectrum here. But they're both developing these kind of evolutionary social theories in the kind of, I don't want to say the shadow of Darwin, in the kind of trail of Darwin, and the development of evolution as a natural theory. And I think Engels even said, you know, Marx is doing for the idea of social history what Darwin did for natural history, and you know, finding these kind of laws of evolution in societies. But I think, yeah, eventually, you know, Marx's ideas evolve, and he continues developing them, and yeah,
it's an interesting history.
Yeah.
And may all of our ideas and understandings of the world also evolve and grow and develop with time. Absolutely. And with new information. Yeah. Sam, thank you so much for joining us live, for having this conversation with me.
Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, I'm very happy to talk with you.
Take care.
You too.
Oh, and everyone, be sure to check out Sam's book. It's linked in the description. Fantastic read.
Thanks so much.
Bye. All right, what'd y'all think of that? Okay. Okay, so y'all have a good night. I would like to do another live at some point soon, maybe later this month or maybe next year. You know, these things are never really set in stone. I will be keeping the VOD up for those who are asking, and I may even start doing stream clips on the second channel. Who knows? We'll see. It is a one-man show. The Androism Project, I would say, for now and for the foreseeable future. But I'm just glad that I'm able to do what I can to share the information that I'm learning with others and to, try and make it as accessible as possible, whether it be through live streams and these sort of interviews, which I'm hoping to do more of next year, or, the videos that I do. I hope that you all get as much out of it as I do, and I'm just really grateful for the opportunity and the experience. As usual, all power to all the people. Happy holidays, everybody. Peace.